Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Game of Loans podcast with me, Sam. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest. Of course, it is the award-winning Emma Fielding. I was going to sort of say otherwise known as the property flipping queen. That's not actually a title that she's ever used, but I think it's actually quite an apt title. She's going to be talking with me all about her journey to become an award-winning property flipper. So if you're interested in buying properties, renovating properties and selling properties, do not go anywhere. Get the old pen and paper out. Scribble down some notes. There's a ton of gems in here that are going to be really, really useful for you. And of course, when it comes to financing these types of projects, there's only one place that you need to go. And that is, of course, Grand Union Finance. We can help you out with anything from mortgages all the way through to bridging finance, development finance, and commercial finance as well. So if you're flipping properties, you're going to need a bridge or you're going to need development finance. We are the broker for you. Check out the links down below to get in contact with me or the team. There is a little link down there for you to click on and book a call straight in with me or one of the broker team. Anyway, let's get back onto the podcast. This is my little chat with Emma Fielding. Hope you enjoy. There we go. We're live, finally. Sorry for everyone that's been waiting around patiently, but my laptop decided that it wanted to update about 1 minute before 7 o'clock. And stupidly, I clicked accept. How stupid is that? But as everyone can see, I am joined by the fantastic Emma Fielding today. Emma, thanks a lot for coming along and chatting to us. It's been a while since we've done any kind of content together. Yeah. So I'm really excited to kind of plot the journey between then and now.
We were just speaking, weren't we, about it, Sam, that like I first spoke to you when I was in the middle. Well, I just finished my first ever refurb, you know, on my first ever flip. And that was obviously a few years ago to now. It's like mental. It's crazy. It's crazy to even think where I was then to where I am now.
But you know what? And this is obviously what I want to get into and what I think loads of people can get out of this is, in a relatively short space of time, let's be brutally honest, you've gone from 1 to 10 properties. 11. She's spinal tapping this. She's taking it up to 11. winning an award, you know, Young Property Investor of the Year award. That is like out of this world amazing. And I think what I love about what you've done is you've done what 97% of other people that go on these courses and say, I want to get into property. I hate that terminology. I want to get into property. You just literally just rolled your sleeves up and got on with it. And you figured it out as you went along. And you are the perfect example, I think, of somebody that has made a success out of getting into property and just getting on with it, just doing it, right?
Yeah, you know what? I think, Sam, you know, you've got to really put your money where your mouth is at times. I think you've just got to go out and do it and just crack on. And I think, you know, for me personally, you know, growing up in Yorkshire and being here.
You're from Yorkshire. This is crazy. I didn't realise that.
You kind of have that Yorkshire grit and that Yorkshire drive, you know, what I call it anyway, just to do it, just to crack on and do it. You know, there's no point, you know, procrastination and doing that, and you just waste time. And I'm very much like all or nothing as well. So if I want something, I go all out and get it. And I think that's definitely helped me scale into where I am now, to be quite honest.
I totally agree. And I've been, like I said, I've kind of had that privilege to get in early doors, have that conversation with you and then watch that growth over that time. Right, before we get into it properly, I've got to say, for anyone that is joining the live stream, feel free to ask us any questions. Please also make sure that you do go and follow Emma on Instagram, because you'll be able to follow her journey. Look at that, like magic. Such a professional setup that we have here. And if you are watching and you're so inclined, you know, maybe take a little photo, put it on your stories on Instagram, tag myself and Emma, and maybe Grand Union Finance as well, and we'll share them all about. But also, as I said, if you've got any questions for us as we're going along, just chuck them in. Facebook has a weird thing where it won't allow us to see your name. So
type your question, type your name afterwards so we know who it is that's asking the questions. But let's get into the story of Emma. And let me take you back. I mean, how many years has it been since you purchased that first property? Is it about five?
So I purchased the first one in December 2019. So I think I spoke to you, Sam, kind of the spring of 2020.
Yeah, I think it was. And from my recollection, that was a property that you inherited.
No. So my dad inherited a house prior to me buying one in 2019.
I knew there was an inheritance in there somewhere.
Yeah, which I did the refurb on that property, and obviously we added value. But we, as a family, we still got that property up in South Shields, in the northeast. But I bought my first ever property in my name, December 2019.
Yeah, cool. And talk us through that project, because you are, you know, you're young, you're still working in the corporate job at that And you just decided, I might be working 9 to 5, or probably knowing the job that you did longer than 9 to 5. And then in my spare time, I'm going to roll my sleeves up and I'm going to check out how I look in a hard hat and get cracking on a refurbishment. And it wasn't exactly just like a little tinkly project either. It was a full refurb, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, Sam, like, you know, the house that I bought, you know, that was my house in 2019, it was a four-story, three-bed terrace in the heart of Barnsley. I actually bought it off market, but I think that's another story for a different time. But I bought it on my residential mortgage. You know, I just got my corporate job working as a finance graduate for Morrisons. And I was kind of doing, you know, the corporate life, really, you know, a lot of working, a lot of traveling. I was training to be an accountant. So I was doing my CEMA exams as well. And I thought, actually, it'd be a really, really good idea to buy a really rundown house. So I bought it for 96.5 grand at the time. Obviously, I didn't pay any stamp duty. I was a first time buyer. Obviously, there's a couple of grand in there for legals. And the refurb was literally 10 grand. But because it was, you know, quite a light refurb in terms of the financials, I got really, really hands-on in that refurb. When I mean by that, I mean every spare minute of any day, I was stripping wallpaper, I was taking off tiles, you know, I roped in friends and family, you know, to do the rip out. But the refurb itself was, you know, relatively straightforward, but I was managing the trades while I was still working for Morrison. So technically I was doing two full-time jobs. And then luckily, you know, I spent just under 10 grand on the refurb, and it was then we actually went into the first lockdown, how convenient, of COVID. And I remember at that time we were kind of all thinking, and there was a lot of news out there that house prices were going to drop and things like that. But actually they went the opposite. They went up because people wanted to move. They wanted more space. You know, they realized that this, you know, lockdown was going to happen for a long period of time, which obviously it ended up being that way. So I ended up selling that property for 140 grand. And then I staged the property as well. So I ended up selling the staging with the property. So that was another 3 grand on top. So, you know, I made more money than my corporate job wage in 9 months. You know, I made 36,000 pounds, and yeah, my corporate job was less, but obviously my corporate job was over 12 months. I made the 36 in 9 months. And then from there, I moved to a bigger house on a better street in a better area, still in Barnsley. And I did the same again. You know, I renovated it. It was a probate estate. You know, I ported my mortgage across and yeah, then sold it and I made another 33 grand. So, you know, in the space of 18 months, I made, you know, really, really good money. And then it got to that point where actually, you know, I love what I'm doing here. I mean, like this for me was like my dream. This is all what I've been wanting to do, is just renovate houses. And I love the transformation between before and after. And that's what just spurs me on, and me being in control of what I want to do and what I want to achieve. So yeah, so it was in April 2021, that's when I set up my company, and yeah, I left the corporate world, and to be quite honest, Sam, I've never looked back.
Well, I know that, because I think around that sort of time suddenly you started seeing the content on social media started like ramping up, and you're on site and you're doing videos, and it was exciting.
I think walls.
That's it. And I think this is the kind of stuff that people want to see, you know. They don't want to see, oh, here's a quick reel of some numbers on a project that has no real meaning because it's literally just some numbers with a nice background and some music over the top. For me, yeah, great, whatever, happy days, that took you 5 seconds to knock up. You were going around your property taking pictures before and after, this is what I'm doing. And that for me is just so much more relevant. And that's what I love about this journey of yours, is not just like, there's not 1 ounce of it that isn't absolutely 100% real and 100%.
It's all so real. I like to give, you know, the honest truth of actually what goes on when you are in property, when you are managing refurbs. And yes, of course you do have issues with trades. Yes, things go over budget. And yes, you know, there might be leaks that, you know, that happen and this, that, and the other, but I try and be as real and authentic as possible, because I think, you know, it's just so important just to give that life of actually what it is, because it's not glamorous. You know, a lot of the times I am on renovations where it's cold, wet, damp, dirty, dusty. You know, you can't go in your nice clothes, you're gonna get them trapped. You know, I still go in my nice trainers and I think, why have I done that? You know what I mean? And
you've got to make sure that in the car you've got the trainer protector things.
I really need to like invest in that. But even today, you know, I go around a couple of the renovations and, you know, there's always something happening. But to me, it's just so exciting. And I feel like I'm only just getting started.
When you just said there about like the cold, like that it's damp and horrible, it just takes back. I did a flip with my dad, which I think I've told you about.
I remember you telling me about this actually when we did this podcast.
And I just remember I've got loads of memories of that particular flip that we did, and we were just really lucky. We bought at an incredibly good time. It was back in the last economic issues, back at the credit crunch. But I remember it was Christmas Eve and I was there with my dad. And bearing in mind, my role in this was I'm the money, right? So I went out and found the money. We did very similar to what you do now. We actually found an investor, but that was when I sort of discovered development finance, all that kind of stuff. I lied to my dad and he was like, you can sort out like the financing of this. I'm like, yeah, cool.
Yeah, no problem.
Nope. Google was my best friend. But it was Christmas Eve and it was freezing cold, right? Wow. And we were under the floorboards and my dad had already, we were rewiring, that's easy to say. And we drilled all of the holes for all the wires on the under the floorboards, and basically we were like feeding them through, and I'm lying on my back's wet, and I was doing this and I was thinking it's 7 o'clock on Christmas Eve and all my mates are in the pub and I'm freezing cold because there's no heating in the house. And I looked down, right, and in between my feet was a rat.
Oh God, that is brutal.
And I turned to my dad, and I didn't move. Like, I just turned to my dad and I went, "Dad, if we stopped right now, like right this very second, and then we started again on the 27th of December," I said, "what would happen?" And he went, "well, nothing." I'm like, "brilliant, let's go to the pub." And I literally got straight up, just left everything where it was, and just went to the pub, walked into this pub covered in crap. And that's, do you know what though? That's just the reality of it. You know,
actually, Sam, something very similar. I think it was project number 4 and it was the first one I used like investor finance and stuff. And I was really, really keen to do a really good job and get everything done on time. And like my word is my bond. Like that's what I stick to. And I remember like me and my best friend on Boxing Day, we were actually painting the kitchen because my joiner was coming in like the day or you know, two days afterwards. I knew I could get my joiner in between Christmas and New Year because then he would work back on his sites. So like, you know, I just remember that, you know, me and my friend Simon, just painting the kitchen and like the other rooms. And I was like, what am I doing? Like, this is Boxing Day. Like, I used to be out in town on Boxing Day, but I'm not anymore. I'm like, I'm painting, I'm doing the miscut. You know,
I'm such an adult. But I did want to talk about the financing a little bit. Obviously, we're on, you know, we're in the finance family Facebook group. So one thing that people that are watching this right now, they might be going, hang on a second, Sam's invited Emma on, and she's talking about using a residential mortgage to buy this property, and you're constantly preaching, Sam, about how you buy flips and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. I have to, you know, anyone that's thinking that, right, I do talk about residential mortgages to buy flip properties as well, just as a heads up. How the way you've done it absolutely is absolutely fine. I think the only sort of precursor to it is, obviously, first and foremost, if you're going to buy a property that you're genuinely going to live in and it's going to be your main residence at that time, then it's fine, which you did. It's absolutely fine. You're not breaking any laws. Yeah. The things that you've just got to get around is it going to be affordable? Because a lot of people might want to get into property, using that phrase again, and they want to be full time. Well, if they're doing that, then there's no affordability to be showing for the residential mortgage. But also, you are living in a shithole for quite a number of months as well.
In the renovation, that is hard. Like, that is some tough going. But I think even like before we even got that house, I had, I actually got a meeting with like a property tax advisor. And, you know, I had a really good in-depth conversation with him. And I kind of knew where I stood if I went down that route. And obviously I only started with £20,000, which obviously now is like nothing. Really, and even back then it wasn't a lot, but having that conversation with him really helped, to be quite honest. And he's actually my tax advisor now, to be honest. And yeah, just having that conversation first before diving into property was really key, because every, you know, person's personal situation is completely different. So the way I did it might not be the right, you know, route for somebody else, for example. So yeah, it's really important to have that conversation first with the
kids. Exactly. And you were in a relatively fortunate situation, I guess, because, you know, you were young, you didn't have like the ties of a big family and all kinds of stuff like that.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I mean, I don't live with my partner, but if I did and I suggested to her that we do what you did, which I actually sort of semi have, the conversation did not go well, you know. Yeah. She's got a 5-year-old, 6-year-old kid, she's got a dog, she doesn't want to be living in that kind of situation. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, but it'd be fun, we can do this. I mean, she loves grand designs and stuff. I'm like, come on, we should do it. She's like, absolutely not.
To be honest, I wouldn't do that route now, because, you know, like yourself, I have a partner, you know, that has a 5-year-old daughter, you know, again, we have a dog, we're very settled. So I wouldn't take that route now. You know, if I was starting all over again and didn't have any contacts, I would either go down the bridging route or the investor finance route. That's the route that I would go down.
And do you know what it is? It's look, the way you did it is absolutely fine. But like I said, I think it comes with the reality of the situation, in that you said your first renovation, what, took 9 months until you sold it? You know, that's a long period of time to be living in somewhere that doesn't feel necessarily like a home.
Exactly.
And that's fine when you're young and single, but it isn't for everyone.
It definitely isn't. And I remember actually, like, I ported my mortgage to the second house, so technically I didn't have a new mortgage. I just, you know, that same mortgage,
which again is exactly the way to do it,
was the same product, which was great. So technically I had my mortgage for, you know, 18-ish months, I think, or 20 months, something like that. But also the mortgage itself didn't have any early repayment charges, because I was really upfront with my broker at the time, saying, look, this is what I want to do, so I don't want any penalties when I come to, you know, leave my mortgage in 2 or 3 years time. My plan when I, you know, started at Morrisons was actually to be out of Morrisons within 3 years. I did it within 18 months, but my overall, you know, goal was to leave the corporate world within 3 years. So I knew I was only ever going to have a mortgage for 3 years. That's it. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And look, you like I said, you've done everything the right way around, which is nice to hear. I think when I, from a financial point of view, what I struggle with when I'm having conversations with clients, and I have to remember that, you know, when people are coming to me, a lot of the time they are coming from a place of naivety, and that's absolutely fine. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there I don't know about, and I'd be exactly the same if I was exploring it. But it's when I get a lot of people that will come to me and they'll put a proposition to me of like, I'm thinking of doing this, Sam.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're brand new to property. And I'm kind of thinking, do you not think that, like, all these other people that are so, so, so massive in property, they've got these big portfolios, they're so professional. Do you not think they've thought about this? And do you not think there's a reason why they don't do it?
Yeah.
And I, do you know what? I'm actually that blunt sometimes to people. I'm like, look, you don't need to reinvent the wheel here, buddy.
No.
you really, really don't. And I think, you know, the way that you've done it is one of, as you've said, a few different ways in which you can get into flipping. But I also think that, you know, one of the things that you were doing a specific strategy as well. You know,
I was very like tunnel visioned. And to be fair, Sam, you know, even when I had my first, you know, house, I said, and I think you even said it on your podcast, that I wanted to flip 10 houses and then reassess the market. Funnily enough, I'm actually literally at that point now, and I'm moving that goalpost to 15.
It's very strategic, this episode. Yeah, I did it on, I've been planning this for months.
And like, yeah, so like, obviously I said 10 flips initially. Now I moved that goalpost to 15 flips, just because obviously when you're in the mix of it, it's a snowball effect and everything just comes at you. But I think, you know, after the 15 flips, I'm going to absolutely reassess everything in terms of like the market, inflation, interest rates, you know, where I'm at financially, you know, where the investors at, what do I want to do? What is my next big thing? Because I feel like, you know, once you kind of, you know, master a strategy, you know, for me, that's been flipping. Now I want to master another strategy, whatever that may be. You know, I've got a couple of ideas, you know, I'm looking at a few things, but it's going to be interesting to see what the next path is, to be honest.
No, I'm intrigued myself, because I know that obviously we've had that discussion of the 10, what you were thinking about doing. And you know what, like I use you as an example quite a lot when I talk to prospective clients, people that are new in property, because I think a lot of people are very, very, they're so focused, tunnel vision almost, on I need to own property for the long term.
Yeah.
Whereas what you've done is you've realized that you might have some long-term plans, but there are steps that need to be achieved to do that.
Absolutely.
And I think a lot of people see flipping as something that is like, oh, but that's detrimental to my goal because I want to own a portfolio. So, you know, from that perspective, you're a great example of somebody that has managed to build a really good quality property business without holding property for long periods of time.
Yeah, you know what, Sam? Like, you know, even when I was kind of thinking in the really, really early stages before I got my first house, you know, what was my strategy going to be? Like, I knew at some point in my life, you know, I want a portfolio. But the reality is £20,000 isn't going to get you very, very far in terms of earning, you know, having a big portfolio. So I knew that £20,000, I had to grow that cash. I had to, like, literally, you know, put more money aside to have a bigger buy-to-let portfolio or bigger commercial portfolio, whatever that may be at that time. So for me, you know, yes, the long-term goal was the buy-to-lets and everything like that. But actually the medium to short-term goal was actually, okay, let's grow this cash pot. The way I can do this quickly is flipping. It was a no-brainer. And actually what I really enjoy is turning something around that's really unloved and derelict, putting love back into it, and then selling it on for a profit and selling it to a local family as well. It's like, it's literally a win-win, you know. And now that I work with investors, you know, this flipping side of thing has just scaled up massively, you know, and then to the point where I think, well, we might as well just do 15. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, the next year, if I flip houses for another year, well, that's another 100 grand, you know, in my pot, you know, to then potentially grow a bigger buy-to-let portfolio later down the line. Or, you know, with that, I could have a smaller buy-to-let portfolio, but less finance on it or less investors on it. You know what I mean? That ultimately then cost me money as well. So I think, you know, the fact is that, yes, you know, flipping it is the short-term solution, but actually it's a long-term gain.
Yeah, I couldn't agree. And the, how you were describing that, it made me think of this whole, there's this big sort of question, isn't there, of what should you do first, business or property? And I don't think it's as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I look at, I don't think of it in terms of property or business. I think of it in terms of passive versus mm-hmm. non-passive income. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for me, Grand Union Finance is a great example because I think that it's my company is like your flipping company. It requires mm-hmm. my attention constantly, and it's quite noisy and there's lots going on.
Yeah,
and yeah. But it generates quite high cash flow. Mm-hmm. Similar to your flipping business, you're generating yeah. money, large lump sums of cash. but for that business to keep going, your day-to-day involvement is kind of needed. Okay, there's a whole different conversation.
It was more needed in the early days, but that's now cool. that it's kind of scaled, you know, I don't have to be on a renovation for a week if I don't want to be. But exactly. me being a little bit of a control freak and me that loves being there, I go there anyway.
Exactly. But you're, you know, you have that involvement, it makes the cash flow, but then it's a case of, and this is basically straight off the pages of Rich Dad Poor Dad, it's the high generating cash flow business over here, move the money into storage mm-hmm. over here, which is something yeah. that is an asset that generates income. And if you can do that, and that potentially is that next stage for you of, well, I'll take the profits that are being made by my property business over here that is cash flowing, it's in lump sum cash, and then I can start shifting some of that across, and then I've got that passive income base over there. And that for me is like wealth 101. It just so happens that your noisy business is property, because it's flipping yeah. it's flipping houses. So it's how you build wealth. It's how you build wealth.
It is. And you know what? Like, you just can't grow. You know, the reality is you just can't grow a buy-to-let portfolio on 20 grand. You just can't.
No. So what? Because money in, money out deals don't exist.
Exactly. They're like, you know, they just don't happen these days, like, especially in this market. But yeah, so, you know, for me, it was just about what is the short-term solution to the long-term gain. And flipping was absolutely that. And I fell in love with it. And I love it now, to be honest.
And you're good at it. Let's be honest, you're good at it. So, talking about being good at it, and talking about the market, lots of people right now, I'm seeing it everywhere. This is not the right market for flipping houses. What is your response to that question? Because
any market is a good market to flip houses in.
That's what I want to hear. Go on, elaborate.
Because I tell you what, and I think people can fall short of this, is that you make your money when you buy, not when you sell. And it's 100% true. You know, for example, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I negotiated 25 grand off a 4-bed detached farmhouse in a very affluent area of Yorkshire, because they were taking like nearly 10 months to complete on this sale. Well, for me, the purchase. And it's nothing to do with our side. You know, they've had land registry delays, they've had probate issues. We've had a survey in, there's more issues with the property, blah blah blah. But anyway, the reality is that particular house is about 50-60 grand under market value, but I've kind of, you know, obviously negotiated so hard that even when I come to, you know, eventually buy this property in the next 2 weeks or so, I can't lose money on this deal. Doesn't matter if I sell at best case scenario or worst case scenario, you know, I'm gonna make money on this deal.
And that's it. And I think the thing is, it's like anything. When you're selling something, you have to just create a product that someone wants to buy. Mm-hmm. And people want to buy things in any market. I mean, we've seen in the last 12 to 18 months, we've been in, you know, some of the worst inflation this country has seen for decades.
Yeah.
Yet, I think in the third quarter of last year,
the most money in the last year.
Absolutely, because you've still been able to sell the assets that you've created.
Yeah.
Because as long as there is a need, and like I said, we saw, I think, in the third quarter of last year, considering beginning of third quarter, it wasn't quite still in double digits inflation, but the luxury goods market was still absolutely booming.
Mm.
And inflation had so it just goes to show that when people want things, they will just go over and above to get it anyway. So, and it's like you said, it's a few different things. It's buying well, That is it's just such, and we'll come back to that because I think it's really important. I'd love to get your thoughts on a few things there. But it's also buying and creating something that people want to buy as what, buying and creating something people want to buy. And then the last thing is obviously actually just finding the right micro area where that market is still churning. And I think that's the thing that a lot of people misunderstand about property is that there is no such thing as the UK property market. There is such thing as 100 different micro markets all the way around the country.
Exactly. And luckily on that point, Sam, you know, Barnsley, for example, you know, where I invest in, it's so far under the national average in terms of house price. I think it's like 80 grand under the national average. So, for example, great win. We're in between, you know, 2/3 cities locally. And again, those house prices have gone up significantly as well. But Barnsley's gone up even more. Plus, Barnsley's had a lot of investment in the town centre as well that's seen national and foreign investment come into the area. So all these things have pushed up the house prices, but yet we're still lower than the national house price average. And actually, you know, when you kind of look at, you know, Leeds, Sheffield, Wakefield, you're still going to get far more for your money in Barnsley. So really, you know, whatever the rest of the country is doing, Barnsley for the last couple of years has actually still been a really good market to be in. And if you pick the right postcodes in the area that you're wanting to flip in, you know, 9 times out of 10, you will do all right out of a really good postcode. But if you go for a really crap postcode, there isn't that demand, there isn't that desirability, and people don't want to buy in that area. So for me, I've always picked the really good areas, but yet those really good areas have still been really under, you know, the national house price average, to be honest. So
that's it. And this is that point I was going to make about the buying, and that's where, you know, the win is. I think, and maybe I'm being mega cynical, I think most people that want to carve out a career in property don't realize or aren't willing to do the necessary upfront work to learn about it. They're happy to go and sit in a conference hall for 3 days and whoop and holler when people shout that they're property investors, but they won't go and do. I mean, even in 1.5 minutes there of you describing Barnsley, you've made some really good points about the kind of things people need to be looking at. What is the location to where you are to one of the major cities? What is the infrastructure and transport links? What's the big plan for the area? Have a look at the local council planning. You know, I get really excited because I constantly look at, because I live in Birmingham, I'm looking at the Birmingham Big City Plan at the moment. There's so much going on. It's really exciting. Learn the areas that are currently a bit shit.
Yeah,
and are about to have loads of investment in it,
and it's like get in them now.
buy now, and then guess what? Like the price will just keep going up. Yeah. It's all these things, and even then as well, you were going into about like the postcodes that are good and bad.
You know,
it's a no-brainer as well, unless you don't know it, because you don't know what you don't know. If you want to sell a nice house, buy in an affluent area where people are looking to buy nice houses, like. That's like even saying that out loud, it sounds too basic, but these are things that people don't consider. Yeah.
I think a lot of it really does come down to common sense. For example, like the postcode that I invest in is very central to Barnsley town centre, but people from outside of Barnsley, like on the suburbs, you know, on the cuffs of, you know, the not so great areas, want to come into the town centre, you know, and around that area. So that's where I predominantly invest in. And if I look like on a map of like the houses that I've done, you know, a lot of 3-bed semis have been in that area because there's demand. You know, people want to be close to the town centre, they want to be close to the hospital, schools, motorway links, you know, and actually it's those house prices that have gone up the most. So I take full advantage of that.
Yeah, but just like you said, it's just the common sense approach that people just sometimes. I think this is a trait of a number of different things, not just to do with property, but people just overcomplicate things.
Yeah,
you know, I'm a great believer in the term, like of the talking about the path well trodden. Mm-hmm. You know, people try and reinvent the wheel constantly. Unless you want to be the next Elon Musk or the next Jeff Bezos, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. No. Just find what other people are doing really well and just mimic it. It's quite simple, and it's exactly that. You know, yeah. you're looking, yeah. you, you're you're taking the common sense approach, you're finding areas, because I get this all the time, Sam, which area should I invest in?
I get that, Sam. And I think, you know, you have to find your own area to suit your own strategy. And for me, I've absolutely nailed it in that particular area that, you know, I'm basically from. So I'm quite lucky in that respect. But in terms of kind of, you know, what you said earlier, Sam, about, you know, your knowledge and stuff, like before I actually bought my first house, I was looking at house prices and what was selling and what wasn't selling and what was on the market. Like I was building up that picture of like area knowledge and street knowledge as well. I think this is where people can miss, but individual streets and what they were selling for and why, you know, one street to a next was very different. You know, I was researching all that probably about 3 or 4 years prior to me actually buying a house. So I already had a really good understanding of actually this house is going to sell for this because I'm going to do this, you know?
So with that in mind, you're going, let's go back to when you were doing that research, because I think this is useful for people to maybe who are at that point now, they're like, right, I need to find an area, I need to understand it. What kind of things were you doing then? I mean, were you pounding the streets? Were you talking to agents, or was it a lot of sort of online research? What kind of stuff were you doing?
Real mix, to be honest, Sam. Yeah, it was a real mix. So like, you know, for me, street reputation is really, really key. If you know, you know, a really good street compared to a really bad street, that will be a difference in the end selling price, basically, of that property. And I was kind of looking then online, okay, you know, let's say if a bad street, you know, is a 3-bed terrace, for example, but on a good street, again, the same type of house, a 3-beds terrace, but there was a 20 grand difference in the selling price. And I was wanting to understand why. And it came down to a lot of things, you know, the condition, you know, the types of windows they had in, you know, if they had a cellar conversion, a loft conversion, the street was really important as well. And actually how quickly those particular houses sold. And it just basically meant that I was building up this picture constantly of this particular postcode of where I wanted to invest in, of the really good streets compared to the really bad streets and why those, you know, end values were different. So, you know, even when a house comes up on Rightmove now, I know straight away if that is a particular street that's going to achieve a really good end value or if it's going to achieve a really bad end value for so many reasons. So, you know, it's obviously you want to look for the good streets, not the bad streets, because when people are looking to buy a house, of course they want to better themselves, they want to be on a better street in a better area than where they first came from.
That's it. And I think, you know, you've hit the nail on the head. This is all comes down to knowledge. It just comes down to, and this doesn't happen overnight. You don't build this up. Yeah, absolutely. What role do agents play in that knowledge?
You know what? I think for me, the agents play a part in confirming what I already think. Because yes, they're on the streets. Yes, they're speaking with buyers and sellers and vendors, etc., constantly. But if I'm already doing this research and I'm then going to them saying, what do you think on this particular property? Because I was thinking that it wasn't on a great street and it wouldn't achieve a particular sale price. And they go, yeah, it wouldn't because of X, Y, Z, because of these comparables. I said, yes, I've seen those comparables. That's why it didn't achieve, you know, 150 grand compared to a 3-bed terrace on a really good street at 180 grand. Do you know what I mean? Though it was that sort of conversation that I was having. And just, again, building up that knowledge through, you know, me knowing, you know, the reputations of each street, me knowing, you know, the online statistics and what those particular houses were selling for, but actually backing it up then with conversations with the agents. And it wasn't just one conversation I was having, it was multiple conversations with different types of agents.
I agree. And it's also I think having those conversations with agents as well, 9 times out of 10, probably more, it's probably 19 times out of 20. An agent's having a conversation with somebody that doesn't have that level of knowledge that you have of the market. Mm-hmm. And actually, when they can have that conversation, what they see in you is a genuine buyer. When they know that when they find you the right project, you will execute and you will buy.
Absolutely.
And they will be on your side. Now everyone says, oh, well, the agent's on the side of the seller. No, the agent's on the side of the agent, right? And
the agent just wants the deal to complete regardless.
Exactly. Because when you actually work out at the end of things, what the agent actually gets in their back pocket and how those percentages work, the difference of them selling it for 10 grand, 20 grand more than what you're willing to buy it for, it's pennies in their pocket. So they just want it done now and they want assurances. There was, I'm trying to think of which book it was in. I think it's in Freakonomics. I don't know if you ever read that book. Yeah. It's fascinating. I imagine Andrew Roberts is a great example of someone that would like absolutely get so excited about reading this book. But it's all about understanding human behavior through different economies and how things interact with each other, and basically the outcomes not being what you would imagine.
Yeah.
And there was a little story in there about American real estate agents.
Right.
And there was a statistic that came out that I think on average, realtors in the US, and I'm sure it would be a similar kind of thing if it was normal over here, sold their own properties for on average 10% more than they did their properties that they took on. And the reason for it is because they were looking for the sale. When they were selling someone else's property, they saw it as a business. They just were like, right.
To get it over the line quickly.
Time and money balance. Whereas if it's their own property, they will keep going until they get the best price.
They can wait forever the highest bidder comes along, really, technically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So all that does is actually show, and look, this is not an agent bashing opportunity here. This is just for people watching this understanding how agents think. And if you can understand how they think, you can use them to your advantage. And like I've said, it's all about showing yourself as proceedable. And this is why, you know, for Grand Union clients, you know, people that are watching this, go and have a look in the documents list. It's available. Mm-hmm. We have a template email that you can send to agents to put your offer down. And by following what's on there, it makes you look proceedable. It makes you appear very professional, and it gives confidence to the agent that your offer is a reputable offer and they should be taking it seriously. And even if it's below what the seller is considering. If you back it up and it looks good, that they're going to be looking at it going, I'm onto a winner here. I've got to convince this seller to sell their property for 10 grand less than they want to, but I kind of want to convince them to do that because I can just get this sale wrapped up then and it's all good. I heard another story recently, which was, and I won't name any names just in case, but they said that they went to a seller, to an agent, and they said, I'm going to put in this offer, whatever it was. And they said, they won't take, I think it was like, I don't know, I'll make it up. Right, I'll put in 140. I'm not going to put in any more than 140. And I said, well, they're not going to accept anything less than 145. And they went back and they said, for every £1,000 you get them to agree, below 140 is yours.
Wow.
And he sold it for 136k. And he's just like, well, you know, you just, it's, and look, it's business at the end of the day.
Exactly. And again, Sam, I just want to touch upon a point, like, you know, with agents, it's about, you know, growing that relationship. You know, it takes time to grow a relationship. These agents are people at the end of the day. You know, like I probably have, you know, really good relationships locally to where I am with 3 to 4 agents, to the point where, you know, I know the cat's name, I know their dog's name, you know, I know when the birthday is, you know, I have a general, you know, good conversation with them. And with that, whenever I'm on the phone to them, or, you know, whenever I see them, you know, they go, oh yeah, there's this house that's going to go, you know, at auction next week, you should check that out. Oh, and there's this one as well. They're only saying that because they know that I can complete quickly and that I've got the cash available. If it's through me personally or if it's through my investors, they just want to secure that deal. That's all they want.
And you know what's so important about that is, yes, that takes the time. And I get a lot of people, I mean, even I use the like the finance thing as an example. People are like, oh, you know, well, it's hard to get started, isn't it? Yeah, it is hard to get started. Oh, why should it be easier for you at the beginning than somebody, you know, 11 properties down the line? Mm-hmm. You know, you grow the relationships with agents that means that they're bringing the deals to you. You're a proven, you've got proven track record. You're a sure thing, basically.
And then this newbie comes along and just has it all at once.
Yeah. And it's not going to happen like that, you know. And the same from a finance point of view. I always say to clients, I literally spoke to a client today, and I said, this first property transaction, this first finance transaction is going to be hard. We haven't got the pick of all the lenders. It's mm-hmm. going to be a difficult and painful process. Yeah. But it's the only time we're going to have to go through this process, because as soon as you've got this one done, your situation is different. It opens
the doors to others, doesn't it, at that point?
Exactly. The first one should be hard. Anything that is worth doing is going to be difficult.
Exactly. And it's
the barrier to entry.
Exactly. Even when I think about my first, you know, refurb or my first extension refurb, God, it's hard, but you learn so much along the way. You really do. And then after that, it's then a bit more seamless. And after that, again, it's a bit more seamless after that. So
exactly that. And look, the thing is you're always going to upgrade to a new problem. But I think what happens is as you deal with problems, you learn how to come up with solutions quicker.
Exactly. Yeah. And actually, Sam, you know, I think my job, to be fair, in property has really, really changed. You know, when I was managing the renovations myself and manage each and an individual trade coming in, now I have a main contractor. And actually, you know, when problems do occur, and of course they do, my job is actually to create quick solutions that are cost effective solutions. You know, that's what it is. You know, my job role is just evolved really to actually, you know, being the person that comes up with the solutions or asking the right questions in terms of how can we make things more streamlined through the renovation process.
That's it. And that is, do you know what? That's just business 101. I think if you think about any kind of business, the businesses that survive and flourish are the ones that solve the most problems for the most people. It is as simple as that. So being a problem solver, I think, is vital. And particularly in the role that you have, you're having to do that pretty much constantly.
Constantly. And also, while as you're, you know, problem solving, you're thinking about finances, because, you know, when you get to a stage where you're running three or four renovations at once and you've got investors, you know, and the projects are investor backed, but also my personal money is in them as well, you know, you're constantly thinking, okay, well, how can I manage this cash flow as effectively as possible, A, to get the maximum out of each renovation in terms of the value that we're adding, but actually how quickly can we then turn over this cash to then grow that pot of cash bigger? Because that ultimately goes back to my long-term goal of, you know, having a bigger cash pot to do more things with.
That's exactly it. Now, I don't want to finish up before asking you a little bit about something that you did this weekend, which was it basically was like almost like just an open weekend where you just taught people how to flip properties and I guess it was just an in-person event. Was this the first in-person event that you did?
It was. So I've done, like, you know, site days where just for one day people come around my renovations. Obviously, you know, they meet my trades. We go out for a nice lunch afterwards and, you know, they get to, you know, answer any questions they've got. And obviously I talk through each renovation because every renovation is very different. But actually this weekend, it was a two-day house flipping course, your guys flipping houses. And so basically day one was the theoretical side of things, you know, going through each and individual part, you know, like how you find your houses, you know, how you find, you know, your area, your trades, working with investors, interiors, staging, you know, everything basically. And we had three amazing guest speakers. And then day two, again, they came to my four renovations as well. So it was jam-packed, but it was only open to, you know, 10 people, actually. because I wanted everybody to get the most out of that weekend. And honestly, the feedback has been absolutely mind-boggling, like incredible. So I'm definitely going to be doing that again. I think I'm going to be doing one in the summer. I think I'm probably going to do three a year, because I'm just generally so busy anyway. But I do like to give back as well, and actually, you know, ultimately try and get more women in the industry, because, you know, I really want more women to do what I do, and, you know, more guys, but just to support people in the process of flipping houses. Because when I was, you know, starting out, there was no course, there was nothing really out there that just focused solely on flipping houses. And I think it's a fantastic strategy to get started with, because it opens so many doors later down the line.
I totally agree. And I love what you said about getting more women into property and stuff. I've actually just realized, as you said that, this is our third live stream, and every single one of my guests / co-hosts have all been women. So
hey, that's amazing.
But it's not been because they're women. It's just been because they're awesome. And that's what I always say. Up until last week, we had a new starter at Grand Union Finance, who I will introduce to you all in good time. Calm down, a lot of you. It was a guy. And up until then, I've been the only guy in Grand Union Finance. And it's kind of like, I'm so mothered by the team, because clearly I can't take care of myself. I'm meant to be the boss and I can't take care of myself. But it is kind of nice to have like a guy friend.
Little like romance.
Absolutely. Well, look, when you do announce the next sort of course that you're going to be doing, make sure to let us know, because we definitely need to
I think it's going to be in June. I think we're aiming for June. When it's going to be in June, I'm not sure. I need to finalize the date, but I think it's going to be June.
Yeah, awesome. As I might have mentioned to you, we are planning as well, I think probably three in-person sort of education days this year. And one of them, I would love to do like a flipping special. So if we do, I'll have to invite you down to.
Definitely, Sam. Sign me up for that.
Well, Emma, thank you so much for giving up some time on a Monday night to have a little chinwag with me. Hopefully this has been useful for everyone that's been watching and listening in. It's just a nice excuse for me and you to have a chat, isn't it, really? but yeah, thanks, Emma. If you're watching this back on repeat, if you're listening to it on the podcast, go and follow Emma on Instagram at Emma Property Developments. Honestly, she's got such a great page. Not only is it just like property porn, basically, because it's beautiful pictures, but you're on your stories, you're giving tips. It's one of my,
on my social media, I would say.
Exactly. And that is the reason to go and follow her. And if you've got any follow up questions for Emma, I'm sure she'd take some DMs as well. So,
always open.
Emma, thank you so much. I'm going to leave you to go and enjoy your evening, and I'll catch up with you very soon.
Thanks, Sam. Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Yep, that's it. Thank you so much for sticking around to the end of the episode, guys. If you have enjoyed this episode or any of the other Game of Loans podcast episodes, please, I would ask you a massive favor to leave a 5-star review. It massively helps me grow the podcast and reach more people that will hopefully enjoy the episodes as much as you have. Thank you so much in advance for this, and I'll hopefully see you on the next episode.